Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today I'm going to be talking about the European Respiratory Society's meeting, which was held virtually between the 5th through 8th of September in 2021. We're going to be talking about six exciting presentations from this year's Congress, and we hope you enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
One of the late-breaking abstracts was presented by Professor Melita McNary from Swansea University in the Wales in the United Kingdom. And it was about how inspiratory muscle training, so IMT, it's a course of therapy that consists of breathing exercises, and it was considered as a feasible home-based rehabilitation tool that could contribute significantly to recovery from COVID-19, and it only requires 3 sessions per week. So the recovery of COVID-19 is associated with prolonged symptoms, including breathlessness. Some patients even report breathlessness for even more than a year after their acute infection. There's really an urgent need to identify home-based rehabilitation strategies. Therefore, Professor McNary and colleagues investigated the role of IMT, inspiratory muscle training, in the COVID-19 recovery pathway. In total, 250 patients recovering from self-reported COVID-19 were included in the study. Shortness of breath was the primary inclusion criteria. Participants were randomized to an IMT program, so there were 200 of those, or to the control group, which was 50. The intervention group followed IMT sessions 3 times per week for an 8-week period. The sessions took place remotely through Zoom. At baseline and post-intervention, breathlessness, respiratory muscle strength, fitness, and physical activity were assessed. Results showed that IMT improved all of the previous outcomes, and breathlessness was significantly reduced by 33%. In addition, fitness was significantly increased by 15%. However, no improvement on physical activity nor on sleep was observed. Professor McNary was pleased to report that IMT contributes to recovery following COVID-19. Only 3 sessions per week showed a clear improvement on long-term symptoms. Overall, IMT is an acceptable and feasible unsupervised rehabilitation tool that should be considered for wider implementation. Interesting abstract. Since the emergence of COVID-19, millions of people have been infected globally. Cases of long COVID are still increasing. However, so little is known about the long-term consequences of COVID-19. So the presentation at ERS was held by Ms. Jala Ebadi from the Radboud UMC in the Netherlands in Rotterdam, and she pointed out that even months after infection with SARS-CoV-2, some people are still really battling fatigue. So in the current study, severe fatigue was negatively correlated with disease severity, and even patients with mild symptoms showed fatigue for up to 10 months after their official infection. So the main goal of this particular study was to determine the long-term prevalence of severe fatigue in patients after recovering from COVID-19 infection. Patients were recruited during their visit to the multidisciplinary aftercare facility, and 3 study groups were distinguished. There was an intensive care unit set of patients, ICU patients. There was hospitalized non-ICU patients, and there were non-hospitalized patients referred by general practitioners because of persisting symptoms. Between May 2020 and May 2021, participants were examined during 2 consultations with a 2-month interval. Fatigue was assessed using the checklist individual strength, and severe fatigue was greater than or equal to 35. In total, 236 participants were included in the study. So fatigue was present in 58% of the ICU patients, so that was 31 patients, 66% of the hospitalized but non-ICU patients, and that was 77, and 94% of the GP-referred patients, and that was 128 individuals, during the first consultation. There was an average of 3.7 months after their COVID-19 had cleared. During the second consultation, that number decreased somewhat, with 52% representing the ICU cohort, and that was down from 58% at the first consultation, 64% of the hospitalized non-ICU cohort, and that was down from 66%, and 75% of the patients that were referred to by the general practitioner, as opposed to 94 from the first consultation. And at that point, it was about an average of 8.2 months after their COVID-19 had cleared. So in short, severe fatigue remained highly prevalent in both hospitalized patients and non-hospitalized patients, even up to 10 months after COVID-19. Future studies will really have to focus on how we can prevent the COVID-19 fatigue from becoming chronic. Although the COVID-19 pandemic has really wreaked havoc for so many people in so many circumstances, it has had a few unexpected public health advantages. And one of these was presented during the late breaking abstract session, looking at the impact of COVID-19 social distancing on the viral transmission and infection rates in France. They explain how an outbreak of RSV was delayed as a result of these particular circumstances. So in France, social distancing has remained one of the main tools for preventing the transmission of SARS-CoV-2, and the non-medical measures implemented during the COVID-19 pandemic have actually had a really big impact on the course of natural epidemics of other respiratory viruses, including RSV, so the respiratory syncytial virus. In the current study, Dr. Ralph Epau from the pediatric hospital Créteil in France and his team aimed to assess the course of RSV infection in France during the 2020-2021 season and compared it with the two previous RSV seasons. So French national data from three networks was analyzed, including data from emergency departments, general practitioners, and hospital laboratories. The RSV positive tests during these visits were compared to the RSV positive tests of the previous two RSV seasons, and that would be 2018 to 2019, as well as 2019 to 2020. So during the 2020-2021 season, the RSV epidemic started in February 2020, which is 12 weeks later, compared with the previous seasons. The highest number of bronchiolitis cases was reported during the end of March 2021, so almost 10 to 12 weeks later than the previous seasonal peaks. In addition, the total number of cases was lower than in the previous seasons. The delayed RSV epidemic could be explained by school and daycare centers that remained open in the second lockdown. Another explanation could lay in the fact that despite international travel restrictions, interstate border remained open, allowing RSV diffusion from other countries. So, in short, a delayed respiratory syncytial virus epidemic was observed in France as a result of COVID restrictions by up to 12 weeks, and these restrictions included social distancing and so forth. This led to raised concerns regarding the burden of RSV in the already overheated healthcare system because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's talk about food that keeps your lungs healthy. So we know that a healthy diet in mid-childhood, which includes fish, fruits, vegetables, and nuts, it's associated with all sorts of better outcomes, including better lung function. So previous studies have shown that these associations between dietary patterns and lung function in adults do exist. For example, the Mediterranean diet has been linked to protective effects. However, data on the relationship of food and lung function in children is pretty scarce. And for that reason, Dr. Mohamed Talayi Bashiri from the Queen Mary University in London, the UK, and his team investigated whether three distinct dietary patterns in mid-childhood were associated with lung function in adolescence. The longitudinal study was presented at the ERS meeting this year and identified three dietary patterns, so which he playfully called junk food, traditional, or health conscious. So junk food, of course, it's a synonym for processed foods, including white breads, sweets, cakes, ice cream, chocolate, and so forth. Traditional food included poultry, red meat, vegetables, fish, and rice. Health-conscious food had an overlap with traditional food, of course, regarding the fish, vegetables, and rice, but it also included lots of vegetarian options, including fruits and nuts. Parents were asked to fill out a questionnaire about when their child reached the age of 7 years, and at 15 and a half years old, the children had their lung function measured. In the participating children, and there were 3,085 of them, so nearly 3,100 of them, the health-conscious pattern was clearly associated with significantly higher functional readouts, including FVC and FEV1 levels, indicating that an improved lung function. The junk pattern was associated with significantly lower levels of FVC and FEV1, suggesting decreased lung function. So, In short, the investigators suggest that aiming for a variety of foods, including fewer processed foods, and including more plants, should be considered as a healthy approach for children to create a supportive lung development environment. We all know that biomarkers are key to understanding the phenotypes, and they do actually help in distinguishing patient subgroups to guide therapeutic strategies in many disease subtypes. So in the novelty study, this was presented by Dr. Bo Ding from AstraZeneca in Sweden, they looked at a considerable amount of biomarker data to the asthma field. So biomarkers such as blood eosinophils and fractional exhaled nitric oxide, together with atopy history, didn't distinguish severe asthma from severe uncontrolled asthma in this particular study. But we know that asthma is a heterogeneous disease characterized by multiple phenotypes, and phenotype-specific markers could be useful in predicting outcomes and therapeutic response to target therapies. So in the previous years, research has been done on the identification of valid biomarkers in asthma, and this novelty study really looked to zero in on the asthma field. The primary objective of the novelty study was to characterize the distribution of biomarkers in severe asthma. The novelty study was a global prospective study of patients with physician-assigned asthma and/or COPD. Patients who had severe asthma or severe uncontrolled asthma at baseline were included, and patient-classified asthma severity was used, with uncontrolled asthma being defined as an asthma control test score of less than 20 or greater than 1 exacerbation at the past 12 months. So atopy history was also available, and biomarkers that were measured were eosinophils and FeNO. Overall, 652 patients had physician-assessed severe asthma at baseline, and 480, or 74% of those, met the criteria for uncontrolled asthma. Distribution of the two biomarkers and history of allergy were similar between both groups. 11.5%, which consisted of 75 patients with controlled asthma and 55 patients with uncontrolled asthma, were positive for all three variables, so having a high eosinophil count, high FeNO, and a history of allergy. Taken together, the overlap of high eosinophil counts, the high FeNO levels, and history of allergy were similar among novelty patients with both severe asthma and severe uncontrolled asthma, suggesting that these biomarkers were not useful in distinguishing between these two phenotypes. Palivizumab, it's a monoclonal antibody against RSV, so the respiratory syncytial virus. It's an effective prophylaxis of RSV infection in high-risk infants. It's given once per month intramuscularly during the RSV season, and when patients are no longer considered to be at increased risk, for example, as they get older, they no longer qualify for the vaccination, although they are still at risk of getting RSV. So in a retrospective cohort study presented at the ERS meeting this year, investigators determined whether former high-risk pediatric patients developed RSV infection and compared the cost of palivizumab with the length of hospital stay. And the goal was to check how many vaccinated children were admitted to the hospital with RSV during the subsequent winter. Over the course of 2 winters, 22 patients were identified as having received palivizumab 1 year, but not qualifying for the subsequent year. And of those, 4, or 18%, were admitted to the hospital with RSV over the second year with a median stay of 6.5 days. The median payment received for each stay was about £1,670, British pounds, while the median cost of palivizumab treatment for these patients would have been about £3,748 per patient. So although the study is limited by its sample size, the results point in the direction that it is not cost-effective to extend the vaccination period. And so in conclusion, infants at high risk for the respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, they only receive palivizumab during the first year of life, and although they remain at risk for serious complications from RSV the subsequent year, the cost of passive vaccination with this monoclonal antibody would exceed the cost of the related hospital admissions. Kind of a harsh message, but that's what cost-effectiveness means. That's it for today's podcast. I hope you learned something. Thank you so much for listening to us, and stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.